Activism is about taking what isn't right or doesn't feel right and making some change so that it does. The problem is that people are doing activism, which is changing the world in whatever scope they can, but only in the limits of where they feel powerful. And we're taught to feel that power is only within our reach on a very small scale, and that power to change the world in larger ways is just, you know, that's just somewhere out there. Leave it to the experts, because little old us can't do anything like that, right? And that's one of the narratives that we need to shift.
How can we make sense of protest and activism in a time that seems so polarized that feels like a haystack waiting to be lit on fire? Does direct action work? Is it working? Welcome to the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. This podcast is about radical change. It is based on a simple premise that a radically changed future may be closer than we think. Today, we get to dig into the promise of activism and the role it plays in social change with trickster artist and activist Ricardo Levins Morales. Ricardo, who is based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, uses his art as a form of political medicine to support individuals and collectives facing and fighting oppression. I first encountered Ricardo's work in the form of an illustrated pamphlet that he produced on social action, titled Tending the Soil. It exhibits such a consilience among its textual content, which includes lessons on power and tactics and organizing, with its beautiful design and illustration. It also insinuates deep parallels between ecological health and regeneration with social action, organization, and liberation. I spoke with Ricardo about radical change, about hope, tricksters, and the problem with building bridges. This conversation changed how I think about my own activism. So let's dig in. Today on The Second Transition, I am really excited to speak with trickster artist and activist Ricardo Levins Morales. Ricardo was born into the anti-colonial movement in his native Puerto Rico and was drawn into activism in Chicago when his family moved there in 1967. In addition to his amazing art, Ricardo also leads workshops on creative organizing, social justice strategy, and sustainable activism, and he mentors organizations working to advance radical change. Ricardo, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ricardo, as you know, this show is about envisioning radical change, about drawing out the very real possibilities in the bold ideas that many people think are too radical or too naive. I've always felt like change starts with having a sense of vision, about being able to really see what one is fighting for and that it matters. Can you talk a bit about how you came to your unique niche of blending art and activism? What have you learned about vision in social change?
Well, I'm kind of stuck on that idea of naive, right? Because I think a lot of my work is flipping the script on that. That in fact, naive is believing that if you organize society around greed and separation, fragmentation of the person, separation from nature and so forth, that somehow there'll be good outcomes. Right. So a lot of even the specific organizing that I get involved in really is about reframing those narratives. Right. And I think, I mean, for me, I think the real basis for how I think about organizing and change, and this has also filled itself out in the way I do art, is, you know, the fact that I grew up playing in the forest. Right. And on the subtropical forest on the Puerto Rican mountainside, where the stories that I was picking up from my environment are all about cycles and lag times and tipping points, depletion and replenishment. And although I had no way of knowing that at the time, that's what I was able to later realize is the basis for how I think about making change.
So you saw lessons in the world around you for how we can better make change, or how we can better live, or maybe a little of both?
If you watch a scorpion and a lizard in combat, or if you watch hawks diving after songbirds, or mongoose going after lizards, there's a lot of conflict in nature. There's a lot of competition, but there's no narrative of good guys and bad guys you can fit that into. So that really prepared me for when I landed in Chicago in the late 60s to be able to look at conflict in a different way. I mean, conflict that's not a, in that sort of good guy, bad guy binary, right? So even now in my art, even when I'm dealing with sharp issues of conflict and making clear distinctions in analysis around colonialism or whatever, it's not about demonizing anyone. It's not about that simplistic narrative that there are evil people and there are good people, because that doesn't serve us well. And any organism, you know, in the forest or anywhere else, needs to have an accurate and nuanced information about what's going on around us, around in our environment. And false narratives just don't make us safe. So,
you know, you're making me think of my own research on conflict over natural resources, where one of the biggest problems that really gets in the way of people's ability to work collectively towards a common goal relates to the false narratives that people have constructed or buy into about heroes, victims, and villains.
And there are differences, too, in the way conflict plays out in different situations and competition, so that under capitalism, the purpose of competition is to destroy your competitors and corner a market. Whereas in an ecosystem, very often the other plants or animals you're in competition with, you also absolutely depend upon for your survival. So again, it is that kind of choreography of, you know, protecting your own ability to thrive, but you don't actually want to destroy all the other creatures that are occupying the same space and looking for nutrients, because that just doesn't work that way in nature.
What you just said reminds me of something written by author Daniel Quinn, who often said, compete to the best of your abilities, but don't wage war.
Here you go.
You know, a premise that I'm exploring with this show is that radical change is closer than we think, which can seem really hard to believe because it seems like people are waging war on one another. There's so much factionalism in the world. And in many ways, it seems as though all of the evidence is pointing towards a backslide in major social change around women's rights, racial issues, and so forth. But the notion that I want to explore is that change may just be under the surface. And I think it would be interesting to hear you talk about this with respect to one of your pieces of art. It's on the back cover of Tending the Soil, and it's entitled Volcano. It reads, "Power comes from below, from the hidden places where it gathers. Until discovering itself, it blazes into view, lighting the sky and reshaping the landscape, sweeping away barriers it seemed would stand forever." That is so beautifully worded. And so I wonder, can you tell me about the inspiration behind these words? There's a lot of optimism in them, and I feel like at least some of it must come from hands-on experience.
Yeah, well, it really, I think, comes from taking the long view, right? So I became an activist when I was in my early teens, you know, which is a good half century ago, right? You know, I've been around for a bit. So that means I've experienced periods of mass movements and insurgency and periods of kind of, you could call, political dormancy, right? And there's still things going on during those periods, but they're not as visible. And, you know, the space is dominated by enemies of justice, right? So it's like a seasonal thing. You know, sometimes it's warm and sometimes it's just cold and frozen and nothing's moving. And so it was actually during one of those periods that I was thinking about this, that for me, when at a time when it seemed like competition had won out, greed had won out, short-term thinking, that people wanted to go to the mall and just buy crap that they could then throw away a week later rather than thinking deeply about change, rather than thinking as some of the sort of more liberal activists are, you know, inclined to think, oh, well, we kind of lost. How do we adapt to where people are at? To me, the question was, where has the hunger for authentic relationship, real sustainability, and satisfying relationships gone? Where are the deep aquifers where that has gone into hiding so that we can create the narratives, the containers, the organizing forms, so that when it bursts out again, we'll be able to make the best use of it and make the most progress with that energy and that power. So that poster really is kind of an expression of that. That what's happened, the invisible is often a more important place to pay attention to than the visible, right? There's so much going on under the surface, so many the tectonic shifts that are happening in a culture, for example. And they don't happen, just sort of at an even pace. They can accumulate, just like a volcano or an earthquake fault. And then when it bursts forth, you say, oh, that's been accumulating all along. I thought nothing was happening.
So what does the scaffolding look like that you have to build up to be ready for that when it does emerge?
Well, a number of things. I mean, I'll speak as a cultural worker, as an artist, right? From the perspective of the work that I do. And there, it's really a question of the tidal pools. I'm switching metaphors here. Suppose when the tide goes out, if you live near a seacoast, what remains are these little tidal pools among the coral reefs and the rocks that are on shore, where a lot of the creatures sort of survive and maintain and, tell each other stories until the tide comes back in again. So that the organization that I helped to found, the Northland Poster Collective, we started it in 1979. Some guy named Jimmy Carter was president, if anyone can remember that. So we've been able to survive during these different periods, these different waves of history, and maintained a basic rhythm of truth-telling. That partly because we made the decision not to get grants, not to go the nonprofit funder route, we never had to make work that pleased funders. So we could be a place where the historical narratives were retained and maintained. And what I found is that when periods of movement emerge again, people are very hungry for that kind of story and turn to the people who have kept the flame going during those dark, cold years.
So, Ricardo, I wonder if you can talk a bit about why so many people don't seem to connect with activism. Activism and direct action really work. And I think, for example, right now of a recent report that showed that Indigenous activists through direct action are having tremendous success at stopping or slowing fossil fuel proliferation. But people still seem to act like activism is on the fringe. You don't solve real problems or big problems by direct action, through strikes, through walkouts, by creating blockades. And we see a lot of criticism in the media about activism, activists and protests. And so what do you think? Why do you think people don't connect with something that is so powerful?
Well, I think the first thing they misunderstand is not realizing that they're doing it all the time, right? Activism is about taking what isn't right or doesn't feel right and making some change so that it does. I want to read you a beautiful little quote from a neuroscientist, right, that speaks to this.
Please.
Stanley Hines is a neuroscientist who studies the migration and the navigation, really, capacities of insects. And he says, one of the main functions of all brains is to take sensory information, use it to generate an estimate of the current state of the world, and then compare it to the desired state of the world. If the two do not match, compensatory action is initiated, which is what we call behavior. Now, where does that come from? How is it that a dung beetle and a deer and a human all have some kind of internal map? And it starts with basic needs. We want to be safe. We want to be fed. We want a temperature around us that's comfortable. We want to rest when we need to rest, right? All of these basic animal organic needs. And when those aren't being met, we move toward a place where they will be met, or we make some kind of change so they will be met. That's called activism. So it's the same instinct that causes me to stretch my leg or scratch my arm if I feel cramped or have an itch, or to call a meeting if, patriarchy is messing with my head, or to call a strike, when we're not being given sufficient safety equipment to deal with a pandemic. Problem is that people are doing activism, which is changing the world in whatever scope they can, but only within the limits of where they feel powerful. And we're taught to feel that power is only within our reach on a very small scale, and that power to change the world in larger ways is just, you know, that's just somewhere out there. Leave it to the experts, because little old us can't do anything like that, right? And that's one of the narratives that we need to shift.
You know, I spoke on the first episode of this podcast with Ellen Kelsey, who wrote a book titled Hope Matters. And I wonder, hope has to come in here too, right?
People used to ask me, or, you know, sometimes ask, what keeps you hopeful or what makes you hopeful? And for a long time, I found the question confusing. And finally, I realized that to me, hope is sort of the organic heritage of all living things. That when a chipmunk sets out in the forest, or a lizard, or whoever, depending on your forest, in search of bugs to eat or seeds or whatever, that's hope, right? They're moving toward something that they want to correct a condition that they don't like, which is hunger, right? Or whatever it is that they're looking for. So hope is, in fact, what keeps us moving forward and breathing from moment to moment. The real question is not what makes some people hopeful, but what blow has been so devastating, or what oppression so heavy and chronic that it is suppressing this natural inherent instinct of all living things, right? And that shifts the attention to environmental conditions and the injuries that they have caused, because lack of hope ain't the problem. It's the obstacles that are put in its way.
So you describe your art as political medicine. What is the medicine for hopelessness?
Well, it's, I think, a process of overcoming paralysis. I mean, my organizing mantra is that the soil knows how to heal itself, the body knows how to heal itself, the community knows how to heal itself, that there are inherent processes in living systems to restore themselves to a condition of viability, right? If we've been injured, I mean, that's basically what resilience is. And I think that it's really a question of counteracting the toxins that keep each of these systems paralyzed and supporting the inherent resilience that's there. So one of the ways in which that becomes somewhat more practical is the idea of how do you communicate with people, right? There's somewhere around 20 years ago, unions and nonprofits and community organizing groups discovered something called messaging, right? It's like, how do you got to pay attention to people if you want to communicate with them. But the way that's practiced, I've come to make a distinction between messaging and truth-telling. Messaging is how you figure out where people are at so you can get them to do something. Truth-telling is how do you figure out what they hunger for so you can light them on fire, right? It's those deep cravings, you know, that are unmet, that people don't believe are possible, that people suppress because it's just sort of pie in the sky, you know, crazy shit, right? It's not what responsible adults indulge themselves with. Right. But now, once you have identified what are the hungers in play, then you have to figure out the messaging. You have to figure out the container to deliver it. But messaging without that truth telling inevitably becomes toxic, because then you're just pandering to whatever coping mechanisms people have figured out to survive. And those tend to be fairly individualistic, self-indulgent, wasteful, and so forth. Another way to look at that is the connection between wisdom and cleverness. The kind of the brilliant innovation of capitalism is to separate, to break apart cleverness from wisdom. Cleverness is the ability to examine things closely, make things happen, put them together so that you can get something to happen. Wisdom is the understanding that everything is connected and interdependent. By breaking those off from each other, capitalism is extraordinarily innovative, but only in a very narrow way, and in a way that also happens to destroy the world as a side effect. Part of our work is, a core part of our work is actually reconnecting cleverness with wisdom, so that wisdom tells us that the power of the sun can meet all of our needs. But you still need cleverness to design a solar panel.
Bringing up cleverness makes me think of your biography, and you identify as a trickster artist. As an anthropologist, the trickster is a very complicated character, and I'm really curious what the trickster means for you.
Well, trickster stories are generally about your trickster character outwitting, defeating, getting the best of some figure who's much more powerful. You can't arm wrestle them, right? If they're a lot stronger than you are, you need to understand them. So you need to be able to do your homework and have knowledge and notice where their vulnerable points are, where your strengths are, and use those to your advantage so you end up victorious. And we, even when we study our own histories, right, when we look at successful struggles, what was it that allowed people who were in a disadvantaged position to emerge victorious in a strong position? And it's generally the trickster. It's using what we have, the strengths that we have, to understand and act on that understanding.
Do you have an example?
So when I arrived in Chicago, it was in 1967, okay? During the period of the emergence of organizations like the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords and so forth, the organizing being done by Fred Hampton and Bobby Lee and other leaders of the Black Panther Party really has been imprinted in my organizer DNA. But the trickster part of that is the organizing they did in what they called the Rainbow Coalition, right? A story that's starting to become better known now, and I'm very glad of that. But they organized with the Young Lords, who were a Puerto Rican street gang that had become radicalized in the struggle against gentrification, and the Young Patriots, a white working class gang made up of kids out of the migrant stream from Appalachia, who wore Confederate flags on their jackets and, you know, had relatives in the Klan and used white supremacist lingo, right? And were also treated very badly, you know, who lived in rat-infested homes, had few job prospects, and were mistreated by the police, right? And encountering these folks, the Panthers' organizing question was, hey, how do we isolate these, you know, SOBs, right? And keep them from spreading their poison? It's why are these people hurting? Why in a system set up to privilege white people are these white kids lashing out the way they are, right? And they built relationships with them, right? And, but as the coalition developed, they shed the racist language and framework and Confederate flags, and set up breakfast programs on the Panther model, organized joint forums on police brutality, and marches with the elders of all three communities against City Hall to demand safe housing. So there's that trickster element, and that also leads me to a dilemma that people are facing a lot today, is how do you reach people who conceive of themselves as our enemies, right? How do you build bridges? I'm not a fan of building bridges. You know, building bridges means you take the Young Patriots with their racist narrative, the Black Panthers with their Black Power narrative, and you compromise. You find a halfway point that's part racist and part liberatory, and then everyone's supposedly happy. That's kind of the Democratic Party model. Mm-hmm. Where I'm interested is where do we go down below the level of the chasm that the bridge is built over? What is the bedrock that we have in common? And in the case of the Panthers and the Lords and the Young Patriots, it was class. Related to that, my own personal understandings of that was my life as a hitchhiker in my teenage years, mostly, where I traveled, when I traveled anywhere, it was by hitchhiking, right? The Poor People's Railroad System. This army colonel who picked me up, who had an anti-immigrant, homophobic, super patriotic, and racist worldview. It took some probing to figure out that what was going on is that he wanted his kids to grow up in a better world than he grew up in, and he wasn't seeing it. That the things that he grew up to believe are sacred were being discarded as though they didn't matter. And the narratives that he understood about the greatness of his country, right? And his children are struggling to meet their mortgages. And that's got to be the fault of these brown people flooding over the border. So that the conflict wasn't on the level of values. It was on the level of narratives.
That is a really interesting example, Ricardo. Thank you for that. As we wrap up, I want to ask you one additional question, and it's a question that my listeners know I ask everyone. What is the most radical change that you would like to see in your lifetime, and how close are we?
I don't know that there's really an endpoint. I think what I most want to see is the integration of grounding and knowledge and historical perspective among the movements for change. That's what would give me the most confidence. It's not any one particular reform, but it's knowing who we are, right? There's no formula for how you make change in the world. But we do know a fair amount of who we need to become in order to make change and in order to be able to see those opportunities, right? And that is grounded in ourselves, in each other, understanding the interrelationships of things, becoming wise, essentially. And then the rest can unfold from there.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Arrow Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. My guest today was Ricardo Levins Morales. His new 2022 calendar is out, and it is beautiful. You can find information about his work in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us.